Now.
Yeah.
Now.
Great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program includes the elements of a successful revolution. From Talk of the Nation on NPR, Shadid Ahmed and Simon Chama comment on what makes a successful revolution more likely to succeed or fail. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Ananda Gopal. Independent journalist Ananda Gopal discusses why counterinsurgency strategy works better in theory than in practice. He explains how the denying Al-Qaeda sanctuary justification for U.S. military deployments ignores the real reasons the 9/11 attacks succeed. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Eric Margolis. Eric Margolis discusses Egypt's fake revolution. He comments on the criminal charges against former Pakistani President Musharraf and reminds us of the still unsolved mystery of who really killed Benazir Bhutto. And then after that, how close are we to the edge? As food prices rise and civil unrest builds throughout the Middle East, Lester Brown wonders if these two could be connected.
Well, let's get a caller
now,
in.
Here's the very quick point. The issue is not America, it's Israel. It's if, for example, a Muslim Brotherhood came to power, not came to power, but shared power in such a way as to alarm the Israelis into something dramatic, that which is very, very unlikely, I think, very unlikely, that would be a classic revolutionary template for power going to the most militant inside Egypt.
Let's get Silish on the line. Silish with us from Allegan in Michigan.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Go ahead, please.
Revolutions in the Islamic world tend to succeed or fail depending on which side the religious establishment weighs in. Could you please comment? For example, Ayatollah Khomeini is the obvious one, and now in Tunisia, the religious leader who had been exiled for 22 years has come back. So please comment.
Shadi Hamid?
Sure. The religious leader that you're referring to in Tunisia is not, in fact, a religious leader. He is not a cleric. I think this is a misconception about much of the Arab world. The Muslim Brotherhood and Islamist groups in general are not clerical organizations. They're almost never run by clerics. They actually usually don't have good relationships with the clerical establishment. The Brotherhood in Egypt is made up primarily of doctors, engineers, lawyers. It has very, very few preachers or clerics at its senior levels. If we look at the establishment, the religious establishment in Egypt, they're largely with the regime only because they have to be. The religious establishment in Egypt is controlled by the regime. There isn't a separation of mosque and state, and that's something that we've seen in most of the Arab world throughout the 20th century. And that's why the religious establishment doesn't have the same kind of authority and respect it once did. And that establishment is very much playing a minor role and not really just pretty much supporting the regime or coming up with fatwas that justify regime actions. So if anything, the rise of Islamism is actually counter to the religious establishment's preferences here.
Thank you very much, Silas. Email from Paul in Grand Rapids. The Nietzschean concept of the Ubermensch comes to mind, given the examples of the French, Iranian, and Bolshevik revolutions. Always like to get the Ubermensch on the program. Tiananmen Square on one hand and Tahrir Square on the other. Those who rise above the law and take things into their own hands involving gratuitous bloodshed get things done. Their ends justify their means. However, those that follow the rules, e.g. peaceful protests, are more susceptible to defeat at the hands of those who do not. The American Revolution, he writes, would be an anomalous example since the Americans did not run around executing all opposition and the established power structure, but we certainly did not follow the rules of the status quo. I wonder, Simon Chama.
If you want to, I'm an Untermensch, really, actually, rather than Übermensch. So I'm completely flummoxed by...
Maybe a Mittelmensch.
Yeah, Mittelmensch, thank you, Neil, yeah. I'm a bit flummoxed by that. If it means that revolutionary situations are ripe for the emergence of some trans-partisan figure, shall we say, it goes back to the point I was making about a figure possibly emerging from the ranks of the army who's prepared possibly to dispose of Mubarak, but present himself in the way in which Nasser did, although the Waft is really out of the, I don't mean literally as an inheritor of the Waft, but represent themselves as a sort of symbol of a reborn Egyptian nation. That's I suppose, always possible. Mm. But there's nothing guaranteed about revolutions. Essentially, again, not to beat the issue over the head with it, it's usually in wartime. Both revolutionary Russia and revolutionary France were beset by foreign invaders, and it's usually, which is not the case in Egypt, as your other guest said, it's usually in that situation where there's a sense of terrified, almost paranoid national emergency about what might happen to the people in the streets and the popular insurrection that a strong man emerges. There doesn't necessarily seem to be anything like that in the Egyptian situation that would make us that apocalyptic. I certainly hope not, anyway.
Historian Simon Chama, also with us, Shadi Hamid of the Brookings Doha Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to Al, and Al's with us from Eugene in Oregon.
Thank you very much. I have a couple of questions. One, could the revolution happen through nonviolence and now in the power of Twitter and Facebook? And the second question, what would happen to those young people at the Tahrir Square from the government since it seems to be gaining its footing?
Can you give us an example, Al, of a nonviolent revolution?
Maybe in India.
Yes.
Well, Simon Chama.
Yes, that is exactly the one I was thinking of. Again, you've got such a lot of good points being made by the callers. The British were, thank goodness, victims of their own liberal hypocrisy in some sense. They wanted to believe, actually, that the Raj could go on ruling in the interests of the masses of Indians. And Gandhi's extraordinary revolution, it is really rightly thought of. You know, maybe as a revolution, it was much more more emphatically non-violent even than Nelson Mandela's in South Africa, was its ability to mobilize millions of people in strikes and marches. But it was, the extraordinary thing about the Gandhian movement after the First World War was that it was constantly on the move. One day, you know, one event would be a massive national general strike, another would be a profoundly symbolic march to the salt pans to the sea, and it was able to really torment the British by saying, come and get us wherever we are in our masses, imprison us, persecute us. It was an astonishing and I think rather kind of one-off example of a massively successful, as I say, it depended on this peculiarly gentlemanly, liberal, slightly hypocritical self-mortification of conscience that the late British Empire had. You don't really have that in this case, so you don't really have it. It certainly don't have it in places like China or Iran.
And important to remember, it was followed, yes, the British left peacefully.
By violence, followed by
terrible violence in the partition. So.
Yes, one has to say, for the most part, a peaceful revolution is an oxymoron.
Well, Simon Sharma, thank you very much for your time, as always.
Welcome.
Simon Sharma, university professor at Columbia in New York, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. Our thanks also to Shadi Hami, director of research at the Brookings Doha Center, with us from the BBC studios at Western House in London. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, I think these fellas are phony.
What's that you say?
You heard me.
Did you hear what he said? He said you're frauds and imposters, that you absolutely don't belong here at all. He said that about us, so I wouldn't ever have heard
that. That's ridiculous. That's an insult. Absolutely.
You hear what they say? They say they've never been so insulted in their life, and they absolutely refuse to stay here.
No, no, please. He didn't mean it. Tell them he didn't mean it.
He says he didn't mean it, and he wants to know if you'll stay here.
I don't know.
Absolutely.
We can't
get out of here. I would stand
for a thing like this.
Of course, you know this means war.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Wharton, and the first guest on our show today is Anand Gopal. Everybody, Anand Gopal is a freelance journalist. He's covered the Afghan war for the Christian Science Monitor, the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Policy, Tom Dispatch, a number of other outlets. His website is anandgopal.com, and you may have heard him here on the show in the past. I learned from the first time I talked to him that, wow, this guy really knows what he's talking about, and that makes him a lot different than me. I've never even been to Afghanistan. I hope to never go to Afghanistan. I don't really want to know that much about it, but I sure like asking about it from people who are willing to go and, yeah, frankly, risk their lives. It's one of the most dangerous places on Earth still after almost a decade of occupation, Anand, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say that, especially for journalists as well. There's been a number of journalists who have been killed recently.
Right. In fact, I think I read that 2010 was one of the worst years for journalists in quite some time.
Yeah, that's right. Both Afghanistan and Pakistan.
All right. Now, so I guess the most important thing that I want to understand is about the clear hold build strategy. You know, my only interest, obviously, and the interest of my listeners, is how and when can we get out of Afghanistan, get our troops out of there, and the generals say we have to, you know, basically fix Afghanistan before we can leave it. As they stand up, we'll stand down, and that might be a while. The president, on the other hand, has said, although I guess he's been forced to back down on this, but he had said that July this year would be the beginning of the end of this thing. It's always been it's a pretty big conflict, right? One big nation-building effort, but you only have 18 months to get it accomplished, and then we're gone. So, you know, I guess I just kind of want to understand, well, I guess really whether the counterinsurgency strategy is working at all. I mean, after all, the army does have a lot of guns that can kill lots of bad guys and whatever. Are they making progress? Can we leave on any timetable ever? Is there a light at the end of this tunnel?
Well, I think if you look at counterinsurgency strategy as it's playing out in Afghanistan, it reminds me a bit about what they used to say about communism, in that it works really nicely in theory but not in practice. And that's the case in Afghanistan with COIN, or counterinsurgency theory, because there's a whole robust set of theories or practices on how to apply counterinsurgency doctrine in a place like Afghanistan. But when it actually gets to, when people actually get on the ground, they tend to throw all of those theories out the window. What we've seen, there was an offensive in Kandahar this past fall, pretty major offensive, and in that offensive, they pretty much threw out every major tenet of counterinsurgency, which had to do with winning hearts and minds. So, for example, they've gone into villages and flattened whole villages. There's a there's a story on Tom Rick's blog on foreign policy that has a photograph before and after of a village in Kandahar, and the village is completely flattened in the aftermath of the clearing part of the clear hold build.
Oh, I didn't see that. Did Tom Rick say, "See, it's working"?
Yeah, they use that as evidence that it's working. Yeah, exactly. But it's a startling picture because the village is completely wiped off the map, and it really brings to mind the old Vietnam saying that they had to destroy the village to save it.
Right. Well, you know, I was talking with Jason Ditz about this the other day, and he was saying, well, you know what? I think they haven't really done the Kandahar thing at all. They've just been picking on the people in the villages around the outskirts. But this Kandahar thing was supposed to be the, I guess you're saying, they've thrown coin out the window. This is the proof of that. They haven't even tried to clear hold and build Kandahar. Am I right?
They haven't tried it in the way that they talked about doing it, at least. They have gone in there. There has been a lot of fighting. But what it has been is pretty much destroying villages or a lot of night raids. On the one hand, it has been effective in eliminating some of the Taliban presence. So a lot of the Taliban field commanders and leadership on that level have actually fled to Pakistan because of the pressure, the military pressure. But on the other hand, it's also, I think, upsetting a lot of the locals because it's causing significant disruption in daily lives.
It says here, Anand, his website is AnandGobel.com. It says here in this Gareth Porter piece, and I think he told me that y'all are friends, he says that you speak the Pashtun language, and I don't even know what it is. Pashto or Pashtu or what is it called?
Well, it's called Pashto. I actually speak Farsi, which is the other major language in Afghanistan, and enough Pashto to get by.
Mm. Can you tell us how much time have you spent in Afghanistan or Pakistan in the last decade?
I first got there at the end of 2007, and I've lived there pretty much continuously since then until a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh. All right, so now I guess I'm trying to get sort of a big picture understanding here, for example, of the legitimacy of the government that we're trying to create there. I mean, we can see in Iraq that the, at least the government that took shape during the occupation, if not the one Paul Bremer was exactly trying to create, has taken over there, and the likes of Murtada al-Sadr say, yes, I will support this government, this parliament, this constitution, this system, and Nouri al-Maliki as prime minister for the time being, as long as he promises to stick by the timeline of kicking America out, etc. But you could say, if you want to call it that, a success, that the government that was created during the American occupation is going to last, apparently, for a little while anyway. And I wonder if that's within the realm of possibility in Afghanistan, that they could, even, you know, not necessarily with war, but by working out deals with the Taliban and maybe the Haqqani network and whoever, whether they could create a government that really would be the government of that country. Not that I'm saying that's what I want, but I'm just saying, I'm looking for a way out of here, and if Petraeus can call a failure a victory and go, then that'd be, I guess, good enough for me. You know, I don't care what he calls it, if he'll go.
I think it's possible. Everything depends on the details. If there's a negotiated settlement between the various sides, the Taliban, Haqqani's, the Afghan government, and the U.S., it's possible to cobble together some sort of agreement. Of course, there's a lot of challenges there. For example, Pakistan has to have a seat at the table. They are somebody who has, they're a country that has interest in Afghanistan, and without acknowledging that, it'll be difficult. But it is possible for that sort of thing to happen if there's political will from Washington for that to happen.
Well, you know, that's really the crux of the thing. I saw a thing the other day where General Petraeus is saying, hey, look, you know, we found these old men and we gave them a bunch of money and they said that they would be against the Taliban for us. See, we're making progress. And I thought, you've got to be kidding. I mean, if that's his standard of it's really working and he's willing to, you know, promote a little anecdote like that as though something has changed on the ground there, I wonder, you know, what kind of even intelligence, never mind political will, is behind the plan and the implementation of it. I mean, does he even know what he's doing at all over there, this guy?
Well, especially in that example that you mentioned where the Americans have cut a deal with this tribe in Helmand, and it turns out that the tribe that they've cut this deal with is only one of four or five tribes in this area. And the other three or four tribes that aren't part of this deal are most likely going to turn even more towards the Taliban. The deal that the Americans cut was with a tribe that had been in power in that area for a number of years, and it was their power and their abuse of their power which actually marginalized some of the other tribes and led them to turn towards the Taliban. So even in trying to reach for a solution, they seem to be digging their own grave.
Mm. And now, The way Gareth Porter portrayed it was, well, we got two choices. We can either stay forever and clear hold and build. Well, this is what he's saying. They're talking about in D.C., right? We can clear hold and build and stay in Afghanistan forever, or we can go with more limited night raids and counterterrorism operations. But in that case, we have to invade Pakistan. And that these are the two policy options that we get to choose from in D.C. right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. Anything other than that, I think, would be construed by people in the administration as a defeat. So that's something they're trying to avoid at all costs. So you don't hear the third option of actually negotiating and pulling troops out at all.
Well, now, how dangerous is all this messing around in Pakistan? For years and years, we've been kind of having them fight a civil war in their own country, and plus allow them to, or forcing them to turn a blind eye and let us have our troops and CIA and drone strikes inside their country. And this has been going on for a long time. Of course, there's big floods and a pretty weak political system over there anyway. They just finished having a dictatorship a couple of years back, and I wonder, you know, what kind of fire they're playing with as far as all this intervention in Pakistan and even the threats of more, as, you know, it was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago and everything about Petraeus pushing. I don't know which doctrine he's signed on to now, but he wants to go further into Pakistan now.
Well, it's a tinderbox over there, and I think an argument could be made, just as people say that Pakistan helps destabilize Afghanistan. I think what's happening in Afghanistan and the war the U.S. is fighting is also destabilizing Pakistan, and this is not just in the last few years, but going back in history, if you go back to the early 80s when we were funding the Mujahideen, the Islamic fundamentalists who were fighting against the Soviet Union, we were allied with Pakistan, with the secret services, the intelligence agencies of Pakistan, and helped promote some of the worst sort of offenders of human rights, some of the worst fundamentalists, who are people who've shaped the course of the next 20 or 30 years in Afghanistan and in Pakistan as well.
Eric Margulies has told me before that there's too much hype. Any hype is too much hype about the danger of Pakistan's nuclear weapons falling into the hands of people crazy enough to use them. But there's one exception to that, where it's possible that there could be a split inside the military, the real government of Pakistan, and if there's a real split inside the military, that could really be the nuclear danger. But he said, you know, and this is a couple of years ago, as he defined, I think he says we're getting closer and closer to that danger. So I guess, first of all, do you accept that premise? And second of all, are we really destabilizing Pakistan that much where you could have a fight in the military over who gets to, you know, these colonels versus those lieutenants or whatever the hell, or which generals, and get to be in charge?
I agree with the premise that inherently it's the nukes are pretty stable unless there is some sort of split in the military. I don't think that we're heading in that direction. The military is still pretty unified. There's some pressures there, though. The more that the U.S. comes over and asks them to crack down on terrorists and insurgents within the border areas, that may cause some pressures within the military. And if depends on what the U.S. does with the massive amount of aid that it's throwing at the military, if they use that in a very blatantly political way to sort of split people in the establishment, that can cause problems. But as it stands right now, I don't think we're there. The Pakistani military is still pretty extraordinarily unified.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream, with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with the drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.